many of them can be combined together to produce incredible improvement and geometric expansion. But most people who spend their whole life in one field don't ever learn that. I got the good fortune of going to 100, then 200, then 400 different industries directly doing consulting, working, doing joint ventures, advising, counseling. I was able to look at all the different ways people do things. I've been able to identify, define, summarize, condense, and extract the key essence, the moral, the most primary organizing principle that drove the success process and the marketing success of hundreds of industries. And I've been able to summarize and incorporate combinations and hybrids which are unprecedented and give people in a certain industry a broad advantage because I open their eyes and let them borrow proven techniques from dozens or hundreds of other ones. So I learned that really quick. I learned if you do that, you can grow exponentially and geometrically, not arithmetically and not in a linear manner.
It's kind of amazing that the basis of growing is forgetting how you were doing things originally. I mean, we do all get kind of stuck in that rut.
The most wonderful sadness comes when you realize that all you can possibly do is what you know. But if you plug in to what 100 other people and 100 other industries know and have learned and have perfected, if you adopt the right mindset, and you and I were talking before we got on this line about mindset, and I think we talked about a philosophy that most people don't have. My philosophy is, what about that can I adopt to my situation? Most people say, I can't use that because my business is different, or we don't do things that way. I look at everything different. I look at everything everybody does that works, and I say, how can I directly apply that to the business I am either in or advising? How can I extrapolate if I can't directly apply it? What about that can I indirectly apply? If I could apply something about that, what would it be? What do I see in that person's success that is already evident in my client or in my business that I can modify or I can translate or I can transform over? And I keep asking how I can make something work directly or indirectly instead of defining why it won't work. And I think it's a change in mindset. I'm trying to give you what Jay Abraham is all about. I realized long into the process that most people build their business on one platform. This is evident in that tape we sent everybody that Tony Robbins did the interview with me. I call it the diving board. If you look at your business, 90% of all the businesses I ever look at, Marty, their entire success is predicated on one pillar or one leg that 90% of their business comes from. It may be a retail location. It may be a selling organization. It may be advertising. It may be going to trade shows. I realized how delicate and precarious and dangerous and tentative that kind of a success basis is, and how much more stable, how much more leveraged, how much more geometric you can make your success if you expand the source of your revenue to multiple pillars, to 5 or 6 or 7 vehicles or sources or paths, and how easy it is to get your business far much more diversified. When you do that, how much more stable and expansive and profitable it can come by watching other people. And I had the good fortune in 10 or 12 of my early job situations to experiment, to take industries and businesses that were normally dependent on one basis of sales or customer generation and add 3 or 4 or 5 complementary ones that people in those industries had never entertained or contemplated, and saw businesses grow 10 times in a year, go from the also-rans to leaders in their field, and saw that every time I applied this philosophy, it worked better and better. That was a very critical distinction for me. The next thing I realized was that most people don't change their strategy. They just try to work harder. And if you're not getting the result you want with a strategy that's not working, working that non-effective strategy harder and longer and more intensely only frustrates you at a higher level. I realized that the biggest distinction a company can get in changing their success pattern is to change their strategy. And then I looked at history and I saw that in history, Marty, the greatest achievements that are documented in business, in religion, in politics, in war or military, in people in the arts, in commerce, in entrepreneurialism, occurred when someone had the willingness to change radically the strategy. If you look at our government today, and I'm not drawing criticism or condoning our current president, but the reason Clinton is our president and Bush is no longer has nothing to do with Bush's competence, had nothing to do with the capital Bush had to put in his campaign. It had everything to do with the political campaign strategy Bush misadopted versus the correct one that Clinton adopted. Strategy is all important. Strategy is a critical element. Then I studied Deming and I studied Drucker, and I realized that in business, there's three things that are critical. Number one is marketing. Marketing is the only thing that makes money and innovation. I realized that most people don't understand innovation, that innovation from an entrepreneurial perspective has nothing to do with sophisticated equipment or technology. It has to do with the ability to bring an advantage, a greater benefit, a greater and more unique result to the customer. That if you've got great technology in your plant or in your business, but that technology doesn't manifest an advantage that the customer sees, you really aren't an innovator. And I redefined innovation. Then I did work with the people behind Deming's, the man who just died, who brought technological might to Japan. And I realized a number of other things, that everything you do in a business is a process. As a process, it can be measured. As a process, that it can be baseline quantified. You could tell relatively accurately how that process performs on either profit or productivity or some kind of a denominated achievemental or result basis. Only when, if, and after you measure, identify, and quantify the performance of processes in your organization can you radically improve, because then you have a baseline to compare against. You know, if you have 10 salespeople and one salesperson averages 10 orders a week and one averages 1,000, you can figure out why the one averaging 1,000 does, what elements or principles or techniques within that person's conduct most attributes or manifests that superior result. Try to identify the universal premises and integrate them and teach them and incorporate them into everybody, because you bring up your baseline. I realized you have to do that. I realized that your goal in life has got to be to optimize everything you do. And optimization from marketing means getting the best current and residual result from every dollar you spend, every action you employ, every contact you make, every distribution channel you have access to, every dollar I think you said you spend, and every piece of human capital you employ, meaning your advisors, your employees, your team people, your representatives, your customers. And that all sort of shake together to make me the person that I am, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes sense. How about, do you have a particular genius that you admire, someone you've learned from who's kind of a marketing great?
There are a number of people that impacted my thinking. Number one is, I read and was very impacted by Napoleon Hill and his book, Think and Grow Rich. Think and Grow Rich is a very wonderful, although a little bit of a genteel written. The writing style is a little bit archaic, but the man interviewed 500 of the most successful men and women of the first half of the 20th century and deciphered and combined and identified the most universally prevalent success factors, and he summarized them in this wonderful little 300-page book. You can buy it for about $6 in paperback, and everyone should read it about 20 times. That was very impactful to me. A book by a man named Rosser Reeves called A Reality in Advertising was immensely impactful for me. It extolled the concept of unique selling proposition, that unique advantage that a company telegraphs to their customers that distinguishes them above all the other people that they hold that they compete against. It's almost like positioning advantage. I read a book by a man named Claude Hopkins called Scientific Advertising, and then I read a book by him called My Life in Advertising. Claude Hopkins was the man who determined that direct response advertising was the key element of life, and that salesmanship in print or salesmanship over the airways or salesmanship in letters was what advertising was all about. It was really selling one-on-one, but in a mass disseminated manner. He delineated, identified, and understood that you have to demonstrate, you have to prove, you have to compare, you have to illustrate, you have to measure, you have to denominate why something is better. He pioneered reason why advertising, marketing, and rationales. I read David Ogilvy. He was extraordinarily impactful, and he's got a book, Confessions of an Advertising Man, and Ogilvy on Advertising. They are profoundly and compellingly important to give you the tapestry, the background, the foundation upon which really effective marketing and advertising is predicated, and they're wonderful, wonderful reads. I was very impacted by the work I did with Deming. It impacted me immensely because I never thought about optimization and its criticalness in the success of a business. I have had the good fortune of counseling probably 50 of the keyest training experts in management, in marketing, in selling, in influence, in persuasion. I could go on and on. I did work with Tony Robbins for a year and a half. I've done work with Tom Hopkins. I've had great teachers, great strategists come to my programs. I probably have such a broad influence, but I think more than the individuals, it's a philosophy. I am childlike in my insatiable sense of discovery. I believe you can learn massively by spending the time to be interested in everybody else you meet and learn about them, what they have consciously or unconsciously determined works for them, and what they are proficient at. Everybody is an expert at something. They are more adroit at that than you are. They understand it more intellectually and more intrinsically than you do. And if you spend the time, it doesn't take long if you become curious and learn the interviewing process. And I would say that the best interviewing process you could learn is to master and model Socrates, because he was the ultimate curious-based discoverer through interviewing, through interaction, through intellectual intercourse. He would basically engage people at all levels of the socioeconomic spectrum. He would interact with them, he would question, he would examine, he would observe, and that's what I learned to do, and it's a great attribute. Does that help?
Yes, 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 it does. Can we talk about one of your big strategies and,
sure.
And have you elaborate? Talk about this risk reversal. You're saying that basically no matter what a person is involved in, it's pretty easy to double or triple the sales just using this one technique.
Well, I'll give you the whole basis, and I think it was evident on that Robbins tape, but I'll use a little example again. In the course of any business transaction, whether it's implicit or explicit, one side is always being asked to assume more or all of the risk from the other. If you recognize that and you recognize that your biggest opportunity in the business process is to eliminate risk, to reduce the hurdle, to take the risk away, to reverse the risk and move it from the shoulders and the basis of the customer to your shoulders, and if you take the risk away from the transaction, there is far less, and I would arguably say there's no reason the customer wouldn't be compelled to at least sample the product in application, at least try the product out, at least tender a conditional-based order for a reasonable period of time. When I deal with risk reversal, I explain it as follows. Your job as a business owner is to find the way or as many ways as you can to get your product into the customer's hands, literally or figuratively, or get it being applied in the customer's business or in their home or in their lives. To the extent you can do it, you take all of the risk away in the transaction. Now, most people, when they sell a product, it's sold either implicitly or explicitly on some kind of a very abstract satisfaction guaranteed basis anyhow. But it's very subtly stated, or if at all, if there is a problem, an ethical and integrity-based business owner will always make the problem right. They'll either adjust it, replace it, refund it, redo it. They'll do whatever has to be done anyhow, but they do it sort of abstractly. They don't really express or explain or incorporate that fact into their selling proposition, although it's something they do as a matter of course. My advice to every client that I ever work with, my advice to every indirect client, which is what I would consider everyone listening to this tape as being, is that the more you consciously and tangibly incorporate risk reversal up into the very uppermost premises of your selling proposition, you own the customer. Let me explain why. Today, more than ever before, Marty, products and services have evolved to the point of being viewed in the customer's eyes more as commodities than ever before. The world is striving to turn all of us into commodities. Our challenge, our goal, our purpose, if you have me advise you, is to refuse, to defy the tendency and the trend and not allow yourself to be turned into a commodity. Instead, ascribe a positioning that you are going to conduct your business as a proprietary. It's going to be incomparable. You're going to be positively distinctive. You're going to differentiate. You're going to stand out favorably and far more advantageously than any other business you compete against. The first basis, the first decision you should make is that your company will aggressively incorporate very definitive risk reversal into everything you do. You will guarantee the transaction to the extent you can, and we'll get in a minute to the different ways you can do that. You will make certain that every time you make an offer to a customer or a prospect for them to avail themselves of your product or service, that offer has incorporated in it a very high level of risk reversal. And risk reversal may be try the product for a finite period of time, and if it doesn't work, we will refund your money. It may be try the product for a finite period of time, and if it doesn't produce a very minimal performance outcome that you denominate, we will either give you back your money or we will adjust accordingly and give you a pro rata. It may be try the product for a finite period of time and it fails to produce a certain outcome. You may have a refund and we'll give you something else for your trouble. That's called a better than risk-free proposition. What I know is this. Companies that revere and incorporate risk reversal into a major and a fundamental leg of their selling premise normally report improvements and increases and expansions of 50 to 500% in their sales and corresponding profits. A quality product that performs appropriately when properly risk reversed will not produce a very high level of refund or adjustment, but owes it to its owner and owes it to the customer to be risk reversed because it makes it easier for the customer to understand and respect and avail themselves of the product. Most people, Marty, never really revere their product or their service or its results to the customer. Customer does not know what satisfaction looks like. Customers do not realize you're not selling a product to them. You are selling a result. The more you can define, the more you can denominate, the more you can quantify, the more you can measure, the more you can dimensionalize and make tangible what performance looks like in terms, in results, in expectation, the more comfort and confidence a customer has in making a favorable decision. If that customer knows that if he or she buys your product and it fails, provided they utilize it correctly and performance is a right you have to impose on the customer, on the transaction, if they perform properly in the use of that product or service and they avail themselves of it attentively and intelligently and correctly, if it fails to perform an expected upon minimum result for them, and result is the key, that they aren't going to be out a dime, that they aren't going to have made a mistake. People are terrified of making a mistake. They're terrified of not getting a good value. They're terrified of not getting the favorable result. The more you help them understand that, the better off you are. I encourage every client I counsel to aggressively and completely and continuously guarantee or risk reverse the transaction. There are many different ways to do it.
As you're talking about this too, if you could explain, for example, someone just starting a business, maybe turning a hobby into some spare income, maybe thinking about starting a business, How can a person approach this risk reversal process right from the very beginning?
Risk reversal has an infinite number of implications and applications. I'll take you giving me abstract scenarios, but let's say you're a person wanting to start a business. Well, I can tell you, let's say you've decided that you're the product you're trying to sell yourself to somebody in a job.
I'll take the whole gradient.
I'll give you five or six illustrative examples, okay?
Good.
You're Marty Smith, and you need a new job. You're either out of work or you want a new job.
Okay.
Everyone else is going to the employer saying, tell me what's in the job for me. What are you going to give me in salary? What are you going to give me in benefits? What are you going to give me in growth potential? If you go to the employer and say, look, I only want to take this job if I can make a better contribution to you than anybody else who's possibly qualified. If I see that I can bring greater value, greater profit now and in the future, that I can grow dollar for dollar, hour for hour, space that I occupy, efforts that I expend, if I can add more current and future revenue, more efficiency, more productivity, more benefit and advantage to your business, I think I can. Judging from this job, I believe I can, but I don't know for sure, so I propose the following. Let me prove my worth on a conditional basis. Let's see how I do in the first 10 days, in the first 30 days, in the first 60, and you give benchmarks. If in the first 10 days I haven't already made a contribution and you don't already see me progressing at least twice as rapidly and integrating at least twice as smoothly as you thought, you have the right to terminate me. If at the end of 30 days I haven't already made a contribution that has made your company or saved your company at least my salary, you have the right to terminate me on the spot. If at the end of 60 days you can't honestly say I've made you triple your investment in me, I'll leave if you want me to. And you always make it conditional. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But I would say most people don't look at work that way. I would guess most employers tend to even view their workers differently than that.
But if somebody said that to you, if you're vying against five people who are all equally qualified on paper and one who's equally qualified approaches it that way, which one would you be inclined to favor?
Well, not a difficult decision to make.
Okay, let's take a business. You want to sell me a product. That product is an expensive product. That product may be a product to only buy once in a lifetime or once in 5 years. I am apprehensive. I am not a little bit uncertain. I'm not sure that product will work out for me. If you say to me, Jay, look, let's figure out what you have to get out of that product in your blank, in your company, in your business, in your home, in your life, for that product to pay off for you, and we together ascribe a reasonable performance outcome. It can be dollars, it can be satisfaction, it can be reduction, it can be satisfaction, it can be protection. And we agree that if that fails to produce that in a finite amount of time, we don't want you to keep the product, and we give you an option. The option could be that you can return the product, or the option would be we'll adjust the cost by any shortfall. That's pretty reassuring, isn't it?
Yes, it is. How about the scenario when things are difficult to quantify? A lot of times when people are looking at a product they don't fully understand,
Then it's great. Then you do the following. First of all, it's incumbent on the business owner to go through the clinical process either on his own, by calling other customers and interviewing them, by working with the manufacturers, because there is data available. No one has ever realized the enormous and in valuable worth it has in incorporating it into quantification. If you don't have quantifiable results, you owe it to yourself to determine exactly what the impact, exactly what the result, exactly what the performance, exactly what the enhancement, exactly what the saving, exactly what the joy level is that your product or service produces for people. And that determination is possible by doing one of or a combination of the three things. Number one, interviewing all your old customers, leading them to help you measurably quantify by asking them questions where they come up with answers for you and saying, well, let's look at what your life is like now that you're using this product. Can you tell me that it's better? How much better? Can you tell me what the savings is? Can you tell me what the happiness is? And helping them produce the basis you use to guarantee. Conversely, you can call the manufacturer. You can ask its engineering standards. You can ask the quality of construction. You can ask what it should have as its performance life or its savings. You can ask them. You can go to other people who bought it from other people and get information like that. You can engineer yourself some kind of a test pilot which can be part of a sales. You can say, I want you to buy it as a pilot. Here's our goal. Our goal is this product should save you 20% on efficiency over the next year. The base of that is our expectation that you perform on your part. Here's what expectation of performance means. We're willing to sell it to you on the basis that as long as you do your part and document it, if it fails to perform this minimum result, we'll adjust your purchase price by whatever the shortfall is up to 100%. Does that make sense?
Yes, makes great sense.
If not, if you don't have that, you can help determine, you can paint a picture for both sides by interviewing the customer and helping them see what performance should mean. Most people don't know what performance means. Most people have no picture for the definition or the meaning or the image or the result of what satisfaction is all about. If you are able to help people paint a picture, understand, dimensionalize what satisfaction means, you own them forever. For example, it's one thing for me to say, buy this product. I think it'll do well for you, Marty. It's another thing to say, buy this product. It'll be satisfactory, Marty. It's another thing for me to say, let's talk about what you should need, what satisfaction should mean to you if you buy this product. First of all, Marty, this product should give you and your family 24 hours protection, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, holidays not included. Number two, this product should always be there and dependable. You should know that if anything happens, if your electrical supply goes out, it'll always be performing. You should, and again, you go through a litany of all the things you should expect that you've never thought about. And you get the other side to say, yes, that is what I want, because they don't know what they want. Or you paint a picture of what they want, the value, the performance, the result, because keep in mind, you are selling a result. Nobody really is selling a product. The whole world of business owners have deluded themselves, Marty, to believe they are selling products and services. The marketplace is not buying products or services. They are buying the results. They are buying the benefits. They are buying the protections. They are buying the profitabilities. They are buying the enhancements that products and services produce. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and I was going to say, and beside that, it seems like as the think begins to change, as the way you view the world gets in line with Jay Abraham, it's like you get a certain verve, a certain excitement about interacting with your customer.
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest mistake I see in people is that most business owners fall in love with their company or their product instead of falling in love with their prospect or their customer.
Okay.
If you fall in love with your customer, you always ask yourself, how much more benefit, how much more advantage, how much more contribution can I make to them instead of how much better can I sell the product? If you focus yourself on how many ways you can make your company or your product or your service benefit the customer, how many ways that benefit can be dimensionalized, how many ways you can take risk and fear away from the customer, you are advantaged. You have advantage over everybody you ever compete against, Marty. It's axiomatic. And people are scared to say, well, if I guarantee to, oh, but I'm giving another purchase, by the way, another premise that I forgot. Some products, it's so costly that people are afraid to guarantee the whole purchase. Like if you're a realtor, you say, well, I can't afford to guarantee a $500,000 home sale. I mean, if it's bad, I can't buy it back. And I say, yes, but you can guarantee every process up to and following the transaction. And we've done this with a lot of realtors, just as an illustrative example for those people who are poo-pooing the guarantee philosophy. For realtors, we say to them, go to your customers and say the following. I will not allow you to sign with me and have me represent you until you've talked to at least 20 people that I have dealt with, listing and selling and purchasing. And you have to ask them privately whether they agree that their outcome was more benefited by having me represent than anybody else, that they came out $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 ahead, that they got their transaction done 1, 2, 3 months faster, that they got more money, that they got less grief, and that they got into a house they didn't think they could afford, and that I got them a greater advantage on financing. If they can't say yes to all those questions, I don't think you should feel comfortable using me. If they do, it should be axiomatic to you that if I've done it for 10 out of 10, I'll probably do it to you. You should even talk to somebody who I'm not working with who didn't go with me and ask them those questions and ask them if they got that out of the person they used. Number two, if you do decide to deal with me, all I can promise is that I will deal with you as if you were my own family. I will worry about your transaction. I will protect you. I will never I will never be spineless or equivocating. I will always advise you and lead you and authoritatively tell you what I believe and why I believe it. I will never forsake you. I will never patronize you. I will warrant to you that I'll always give you my best reason, professional advice, and sometimes it'll be not to buy something that would make me money or not to sell something that would make me money because it's not in your best interest, and I'll tell you a better strategy and why. If you follow my advice and when you make the transaction, if you're buying a house, for example, and you move into that house and you can't honestly say that you are happy at the end of 1 year, I will sell the house for you for no commission, and I will pay half your cost to move out. That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very, very true.
So you can use risk reversal 100%, or you can use it on a modified, but you have to use it if you want distinction, and you have to want distinction if you want advantage. And if you don't want advantage, you're destined to be a rudderless commodity whose business is going to regress and going to die.
Can you generate a business letter, some kind of letter that would entail this, that would help any of us get started? And I don't know if you want to gear it to maybe the person who wants a career path, someone who's starting a business.
Well, I'd rather give you a model with components. I mean, I can freeform right now talk to you about, I mean, maybe a letter is the wrong word because some people will use it as a letter. Some people use it as a model script for their salespeople in the field. Some of them use it for incorporation into advertising. Some people will use it for the people that they have in their offices who handle orders or who meet people on their selling floor or behind counters. Some of them will use it in telephone selling situations. But I'll give you some key fundamentals.
Please, please.
Okay. The first thing is you take the position that I have a result. I know my product or my service or my company can produce for you that you've never even recognized you should want for yourself. My wish for you is that you allow yourself the greater result that you can get out of this product or service, and that I know that I can produce that for you. I know it with such confidence that I'm willing to guarantee you get that outcome or a superior one, or I won't consider the purchase transaction binding. I know it. I can do it because I have these results from all the other people who have worked for it. For example, you share with them other people and what their outcome was. I think this is what and why you should want this outcome. And you go with, you go over a projected, what I call future pacing of take them on a journey to what it will be like when they have this product or your service in place, and they are availing themselves of it, and they are reaping the result, key is result, the benefit, what it will be like. Then you give them examples, and you measure it. Then you say, here's the only way I will sell this product to you. As long as you guarantee me, or you, it's not guarantee, as long as you warrant to me or agree that you will apply the product or the service properly and continuously as it was intended, and we'll go through that when we sell it or when we deliver it or when we formalize it, I am only too happy to guarantee you a minimal outcome of either joy or satisfaction, and describe what satisfaction is, or tangible results, or improvement, or savings, or productivity, or whatever. If you fail to get that, I don't expect you to have paid that full price. I will adjust the price by a pro rata up to blank, or I will take the product back, or I will replace it, or I will send people out to adjust it or redo it until you get that outcome. In short, if I can't produce a superior result that gives you advantage that we both agree upon is a fair and reasonable expectation for you to desire, expect, and depend upon for spending the money or making the investment, I don't want the transaction. I mean, I'm sort of, that's a general one, but that's a good model, Marty.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds good as a general outline. Just as I'm thinking here about the, basically revolutionary way you look at turning yourself...
And evolutionary.
Okay.
You've got to keep evolving. You got to evolve to the point of being sensitive. See, I'm stepping on you, but I want to make an interrupted question.
Please.
When I work one-on-one with a client, the client isn't my real client. I am advocating I am championing, I am solely focused on their customer and what will advantage the customer, what will compel the customer, what will benefit the customer, what will enrich the customer. I think everybody's got to realize, whether you like it or not, your challenge, your goal, your purpose is to become a value creator for customers. And since I'm doing it vicariously for people through this tape, they've got to decide to do it themselves. The customer doesn't care about your needs. I don't know if we talked about this on the last tape or not, did we?
Not very extensively. Go ahead and talk about that just briefly.
Well, when I'm doing a training program and I've got 200 people in the room and they paid me $5,000 or $25,000 and I do three different levels of program, I say to them, look, you guys don't care why I'm in this room. You don't care if I feel sick. You don't care if I'm going to lose my house if I don't come up with a $200,000 payment. You don't care about any reason why I'm here. All you care about is I sure as heck better give you a multiple of your $5,000 or $25,000 investment in value and information and advantage and ideas and benefits, or you're going to be pretty darn upset. If you realize that no one, unfortunately, cares about you, they care, they're consumed totally about themselves. The people listening to this tape, they're on pins and needles. They sure as heck better get value every month from this tape from me, or they're going to be very displeased. Understand, you are a human being who's consumed with your own self-interest. That is good. It's not bad. That's the way it is and the way it should be. When you understand that the people you deal with, your customers and prospects, are no different. All they are obsessed and consumed about is what's in it for them. They feel violated. They want to make sure they get full advantage, but they don't understand what advantage means because no one's ever helped them draw a picture of it. When you learn how to draw a picture of what advantage is, what benefit is, what result is, what satisfaction is, what advantage really means, you can own them because none of your competitors do it.
So the wizard's edge, in essence, is evolving to the place in your own life and a mentality that you understand how that works.
Well, that you subordinate your own self-interest and become totally redirected into what will give, what will render the greatest contribution, the greatest value, the greatest satisfaction, the greatest benefit, the greatest fulfillment to the customer. Not only financially or tangibly, but emotionally, because the greatest achievements and the greatest accomplishments and the greatest fulfillments people get are not tangible. They are usually emotional. If you think in your life, the greatest moments in your life, the greatest times, it probably wasn't financially denominated. Maybe it's when you had the birth of your first child, or your wife said yes, she'd marry you, or your husband asked you, or your kid graduated, or you bought your first house, but it wasn't really the money issue. It was the pride issue. It was the acknowledgement of having worth. It was a lot of things, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.